From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, we take a look at the most streamed songs and artists of the year. Then pianist and composer Chris Bowers wrote and performed music for Green Book, a movie about Don Shirley, a legendary jazz pianist who toured the segregated South. Bowers also gave Mahershala Ali, who plays Shirley, a piano lesson.
We were only actually supposed to meet for an hour for that first meeting, and we ended up spending 3 hours just playing a C major scale over and over again, and it's only because Mahershala would not stop playing.
And Bowers plays for us, all that on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us.
I hold back, sometimes I won't. Yeah. I feel good, sometimes I don't.
Yeah. Apple and Spotify have put out their list of the most streamed songs and albums of 2018, and that's Drake's God's Plan, which is the most streamed track on Spotify this year. Drake topped all the lists except for the one he didn't qualify for, the number one spot on Spotify's list of most streamed female artists, and that went to Ariana Grande. When it comes to the streaming business itself, Apple Music now has 56 million subscribers. Spotify claims 87 million paying subscribers, along with 109 million ad-supported active users. But overall, how healthy is the music business? I put that question to Jem Aswad, senior music editor at Variety.
I'm looking for wood to knock on. The music business is in better shape than it's been in decades. And there's a little bit of concern about what the future may hold because, you know, Spotify has made some ambitious forecasts about reaching profitability, which they never have and show no signs of doing. But there's no denying the fact that they have, I won't say single-handedly, but they certainly have led the revival of the music business, which was in the absolute doldrums 7 or 8 years ago.
And as the revenue increases, even if the profits aren't yet material, are artists and record labels getting what they believe to be a fairer cut from streaming services?
Well, what you just said is hilarious because they never think they're getting enough. Often with good reason. If you're a huge streamed artist on one of the paid streaming services, I'm not really talking about YouTube, you can make a ton of money from it. Like Drake is making tons of money from streaming. But lower level, even medium level artists probably are not seeing anywhere near those sorts of numbers. You always hear about artists saying, hey, look at my Spotify check, I got $475. Not realizing that in many cases, not all cases, the money's going to the record label first. So, you know, the artist maybe could take a look at how much their label is keeping before they attack Spotify.
Let's now talk about some of the top 100 songs from Apple's rankings. It pains me to do it, but let's play a little bit of Post Malone's Rockstar. Okay, it only gets worse from there, but it's very top-heavy. The top five songs are from just two artists, Drake and Post Malone, and there are quite a few songs near the top of the list from just a couple of artists, people like Migos and Cardi B. So are the rich getting richer? Is it really top-heavy, or has it always been that way?
It hasn't always been that way. It varies year by year. Drake's domination is hard to explain except in cultural terms. These are just the most popular artists. And the year, like I've been saying since the middle of the year, this year has been about like three or four artists. It's about Drake, it's about Cardi B, it's about Post Malone. And, you know, there you really drop down to a next level of Camila Cabello and, you know, XXXTentacion. When we were talking about year-end coverage and things that we were going to do, it was like, okay, Drake, Cardi, or Post. That's it.
Spotify notes that hip-hop dominated its charts in 2018, but that three Latin artists, J Balvin, Ozuna, and Bad Bunny, landed on the top 10 most streamed artist list. Is that true more broadly, that even if hip-hop is strong, there's growth for other genres of music?
Of course there is. Well, except rock, but that's a different story. Two things I would note there. Number one is that Latin has embraced streaming in a huge way, and it has been growing exponentially over the past several years. I would also note that Bad Bunny and J Balvin, while big artists on their own, a lot of those numbers come from being featured on Cardi B's song, I Like It.
They call me Cardi, Cardi, banging body, spicy mommy, hot tamale, hotter than a somali, burn.
So it's one of the biggest records of the year, and that accounts for some of that. So I wouldn't overly conflate it with like this explosion of Latin on streaming, although it is growing and growing and growing, and I believe it's the biggest growing, fastest growing genre on streaming services. But, you know, part of that is due to Cardi B, who is also Hispanic.
Let's talk about how things break down according to gender. There are no women in Spotify's top five most streamed artists or most streamed tracks list. In their top five albums, only one female artist, Dua Lipa, breaks through. Is it similar with Apple and other streaming platforms?
Well, like I said, I'm looking at Apple songs right now. You've got Cardi, you've got Camila in the top 10, and just scrolling down to 20, Bebe Rexha with Florida Georgia Line and Ariana Grande. I mean, it's going to make for an interesting Grammys because, you know, with all the step up last year, you know, the poor female representation, the low female representation, I think there's going to be a substantial effort within the Academy to improve that, but you can't work with what isn't there. You know, there are so many great female artists making great music right now. They may not be getting the push that a lot of the male artists are. A large part of that is due to the ubiquity of hip hop, which has a, comparatively huge, much larger percentage of male performers than female ones. So that's part of it. R&B is not quite so bad. Pop is, you know, pop has a fair number of major female artists. But even in past years when, past years of the Grammys, when you'd see all the news coverage saying it was ladies' night at the Grammys, you know, I mean, that was usually one or two artists, Taylor, Adele, Beyonce. And, you know, if they were off cycle, there was low representation for female artists at the Grammys. It really tends to be just, you know, five or six or per year, maybe 10 female artists who are even in the conversation.
Jem Aswad is the senior music editor at Variety. Jem, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
I see the moon, I see the moon, I see the moon. Oh, when you're looking at the sun.
Up next on The Frame, the musician-composer Chris Bowers was literally born to play the piano.
Not a fool.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Chris Bowers is one of Hollywood's fastest rising stars and the man behind the music of the new movie Green Book, starring Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali. Bowers studied at the Colburn School here in L.A. and then at Juilliard. He won the prestigious Thelonious Monk International Jazz Piano Competition at 22 years old. At a recent live event here at KPCC, Bowers performed his competition-winning selection, Shuffle Boyle. Now, all of 29, Bowers is very much in demand. He's performed with Jose James, Marcus Miller, Kanye West, and he's even scoring a Madden football video game. Green Book tells the story of the late pianist Don Shirley and his tour of the segregated South with a white driver in the 1960s. Bowers wrote the score for the film and was the piano-playing double for Mahershala Ali, who plays Shirley. Chris Bowers, welcome to The Frame.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
So we're going to hear you play the piano. You have a story about your parents. They decided at a pretty early age, right, that this was going to be your instrument. How old were you?
Negative. My parents decided when I was still in the womb that they wanted me to be a pianist. And they're not musicians at all. My dad was a drummer for a second when he was in high school, and his father didn't let him pursue that, and so I think this was like payback for that. And they would find piano music to put on my mom's stomach when she was pregnant with me.
Really? So was it jazz? Was it Bach? What were you listening to?
It was literally like piano music from the grocery store. It was just really random. They showed me the CD. I have to ask them to find it, but it's kind of like more new age kind of a sound. But it was just very relaxing, almost like spa piano music.
I guess they could have chosen that you'd be a harpist or a sousaphone player, so piano wasn't the worst instrument.
That's true. Yeah.
When did you actually sit down at one, and when did you start taking lessons?
So I started when I was about 4 or 5. They found a small school here called Yamaha where it kind of taught based on the Suzuki method, essentially, and you're learning solfege, you're learning theory, you're learning how to read music. And when I was about 8 or 9, I transitioned to private lessons. I started going to the Colburn School here.
You say that your dad was a great supporter of yours and was at most of your lessons. And then there comes a time, I think, when you and your dad have a little bit of an argument. What happened?
Yeah, we had used to have the piano in my living room in our house growing up. And there was a couch behind the piano. My dad literally sat on that couch every day while I practiced from the time I was like 5 until 15. And we got into a big fight about it because at that time is when I was starting to do a lot of competitions and a lot of like shows and gigs and things like that. And with my dad, it was always about competition. It was always about, even from the time I was 4 or 5 at that Yamaha school, he would always find, there's a girl named Portia Doubleday she's actually an actress now, but she was like the person that my dad would always be like, oh, well, Portia's playing this song. What are you going to play? At like 5 years old. And so then when it got to the point where I was in high school and I was playing with these, I went to LA County High School for the Arts here, and that jazz program is really incredible and really, it gives us the tools, it gives students the tools to be able to learn the jazz vocabulary and start learning how to express yourself with that vocabulary as opposed to regurgitating like lines or things like that. And so being at that school and realizing that all these people that were my age were kind of figuring out how to express themselves, and it was more so about expressing yourself honestly in the moment, however it comes, as opposed to with my dad, it was more about let's practice your solo and come up with like the most impressive things that you can play to wow people. And so, yeah, we got into this fight because for me, it started to be more about trying to figure out how I could express myself and how I could do that honestly and without any inhibitions in the moment, as opposed to trying to impress people.
So when you get your first jobs doing film scoring, how would you describe the best and most fruitful conversations that you're going to have with a filmmaker or TV director about what the music needs to do for the job that you're hired for?
For sure. I think it's best when directors talk in the same way they would talk with an actor. I think that most composers, you know, our job is to translate emotion into music, and a lot of times directors will get caught up with the idea that they need to know music or they need to talk music to the musician, and a lot of times that actually ends up being very counterintuitive because then we're talking about, you know, this should be a major chord versus a minor chord, and a lot of times a director is talking about that because they assume that a minor chord is going to mean sad or a major chord is going to mean happy, and obviously we can make a major chord sound sad, or we can do different things like that. And so it's best when they kind of trust the composer and also give us the freedom to fail, or at least like feel like we can.
So Green Book is a very interesting film in that you have two roles on this movie. And for those of you who don't know, Green Book is a story about the real pianist Don Shirley, who goes on a road trip in the early 60s through the South. And he is accompanied by a man who is basically a bouncer, played by Viggo Mortensen, and they form a friendship on the road. And one of the things that you have to do in this film is you have to come up with a score, and you are performing some of the piano music that Don Shirley is playing, because Mahershala Ali, great actor, not quite on the same level of you as a pianist. So let's talk about Don Shirley first. What did you know about him, and what did you come to understand and appreciate about him in putting together the music for this film?
Yeah, I think I didn't know anything about him before the film, actually. I hadn't heard of him, and so it was really amazing to hear this pianist that he has an incredibly unique way of combining the jazz and classical sound. Also, he's really influenced by a lot of early gospel music and Negro spirituals and things like that. And so I had never really heard somebody take the jazz vocabulary but then perform it in a way that sounded like a classical pianist, essentially, or a classical musician. And so hearing one of the first pieces I heard him play was Lullaby of Birdland.
Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh.
He starts off with this piano fugue. He takes the beginning of the melody and then turns it into a fugue. And it just kind of blew my mind that he was doing this. And when he went to go improvise, he's like improvising with both hands, which is something that very few pianists actually can do, where you're playing separate ideas in each hand and all that. And so, I was immediately pretty floored by his music.
You brought it up. Let's hear a little bit of Lullaby of Birdland. As Don Shirley would play it. So in your earliest conversations with Mahershala Ali about playing Don Shirley, where do you begin?
Yeah, so I wanted to just start with just kind of the basics. Our first lesson, I wanted to just kind of give him a major scale to play and some fingering techniques to kind of get his finger independence up. And we were only actually supposed to meet for an hour for that first meeting, and we ended up spending 3 hours just playing a C major scale over and over again. And it's only because Mahershala would not stop playing. And he would just play it once and get it wrong, start over, play it again, get it wrong, start over, play it, get it right, start over, get it right, start over. And then I would have to tap on him if I wanted him to stop or if I wanted to give him a note, because if I even said anything, he wouldn't hear me. He would just keep playing. And it was pretty fascinating that by the end of that first lesson, we were able to play a C major scale with both of his hands up and down two octaves, which, I mean, sounds simple, but it's something that I've given a lot of first lessons that's never happened before in a first lesson. We worked together for about 3 months. And wow. So by month two, we were able to look at, here's the melody to Happy Talk, or here's the first few chords to Blue Skies, or these things that are a little bit more digestible.
And it sounds like, too, Mahershala has recognized that you certainly have helped him out. He's not doing what a lot of actors do when they have a stunt double, say, I did my own stunts. He's acknowledging that, is it live or is it Memorex? Is it Mahershala? Is it Chris Bowers? That maybe it's a little bit more Chris.
Yeah, which is it's really awesome. I mean, the whole team has been pretty. It's been amazing to see how much they've been supportive of me and like really trying to talk about my contribution to the film and stuff. But yeah, Mahershala, we were directed to not talk about it very much or to answer the question in a very political way. And I remember talking to Mahershala about it, and he was just like, I mean, if anybody asks me, I'm not going to say I played piano. Like, what are you talking about? he's always been, really, really generous with that, which is really nice.
When Don Shirley played, he had an unusual orchestration. He played piano, bass, and cello, right?
Yeah.
Not piano, bass, and drums. How did that change his sound, and how many existing recordings are there of Don Shirley's music that you can work off of?
So I think there's about 6 or 7 albums. The way that changed the sound is one, just in terms of volume. You're able to play things that are much more intimate. And I think the other thing, too, is that now you have this other melodic instrument that can play other counterpoint lines. And so it was interesting to study his music, and he was getting all these interesting sounds from this instrument, and there's just a little bit more, I guess, malleability with that instrumentation.
Coming up, more with musician and composer Chris Bowers.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change. Because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Now, let's get back to my conversation with Chris Bowers, the composer of Green Book, which was recorded in front of a live audience at KPCC. The film is based on the true story of pianist Don Shirley, who toured the segregated South in the 1960s. Shirley was known for blending jazz and classical music with African-American spirituals. So when Bowers composed the score for the film, he borrowed some of those same ideas.
We wanted to first make sure that the sound was different from the score and the Don Shirley pieces. And so as John just said, the Don Shirley trio was piano, bass, and cello. And then with the score, most of it, say about 90% of it, is orchestral. And with that different sound, we wanted to then figure out how we could create some continuity between the two things. And looking at Don Shirley's interests and the things that inspired him, it reminded me of a story that I heard about Dvorak. And Dvorak, when he was asked to come teach here in the States back in like the 1800s, while he was here, he had an African-American student. And that student actually started to sing for him Negro spirituals and old gospel melodies and all these things that he had never heard before. And so as he was looking at that, he then went to go look further into even Native American folk music and also just other types of American folk music from that time. And so then he started to tell these faculty members and these students that they actually should be listening to those people for inspiration for their music, because that's where all the great classical composers really got their melodies from. It's all folk music. Like Stravinsky, Dvorak himself, they would all, their symphonies are based on these folk melodies. And so he was saying that, I really hope that America builds its repertoire, its sound, from these folk songs or these Negro spirituals and all these different things. And so then I was looking at some of Don Shirley's music where he touched on some of that. So he has a song called, or he plays a song called Waterboy. And that song is like, so it's like very simple, and it's just all about something that feels good. And so I started to look at some of the pieces that he played and also look at other folk melodies or other early gospel songs, and started to try to write my themes for the score based on those ideas. And then I would choose to orchestrate it in this way that would kind of mirror some of Don Shirley's classical influences. And so one of the first cues that I wrote for the film, well, so there's a scene in there where Mahershala, it's being driven, obviously, and their car breaks down, and so they get out of the car for a moment to see what's going on. And as Vigo's character, Tony, is looking under the hood, Mahershala just kind of has a moment, and he stands there, and he looks out, and there's a bunch of black field workers. There's a moment of recognition of the, obviously, similarity, but the striking difference between where they are. And there's no words in that whole scene, but it's the first scene that I felt like I can really see, and even just like the shimmer in Mahershala's eyes, how the pain and isolation and the solitude that Don Shirley himself must have felt, even though he's doing this incredibly courageous thing by touring in this space that where he's not accepted. At the end of the day, he's also representing a group of people that he also feels very much apart from.
As a pianist and as a composer, what is it like to be in a session with an orchestra and listen to them play your music? What was that like?
It's pretty amazing. I had to keep reminding myself that I was there to make sure that everything was or listen for mistakes. I was too busy enjoying it, actually. that was my first time having that many people play my music and people of that caliber. And of course, like in the middle of a scoring session, you're trying to keep your eye on the clock and make sure that you're taking the appropriate breaks and all that kind of stuff, and you're going to get the amount done in the time that you have. But it just kind of was a moment where I was finally like, wow, this is what I've been trying to do since I was like 9. And it's pretty cool to be able to see it happen. Yeah.
Yesterday on the show, for all those who listened, we had Jose James talking about his album of Bill Withers covers. You played piano with Jose James.
Yes.
You worked with Justin Simeon on Dear White People. You've worked in hip-hop music. How do you make sure that you are not pigeonholed, that people see you in a different way every week?
Yeah, I think whenever I talk to people, just kind of just trying to talk as much about all the things that I'm into as possible and connect with the right people that then are gracious enough to kind of give me an opportunity. I think a good example is I'm about to start working on the next Madden video game to score, which is pretty exciting. And they called me and they're like, we need a country song, and our person that was writing it can't do it or is not showing up at the last minute, and we actually need it by tomorrow. Can you do that for us? And for them to have that trust in me, I think just shows, one, the conversations that we had, I think, showed them that I am much more than maybe what I might be on paper. And so I think it's my responsibility then to any opportunity I'm given that's outside of maybe the box that people are trying to put me in, to just really go as hard as I can to show them that I can do something outside of that box.
We're going to end this conversation. Chris, he doesn't know this is coming, but he might know it's coming. He knows what's coming.
Yeah.
So I'm going to play film director. And I'm making a movie. It's called Stormy Waters.
Okay.
And it's about a couple. They're out at sea. They're on a sailing trip around the world. And they've realized that their marriage is really kind of crumbling. And they've got to pull it together because there's a storm on the horizon. So I need a 4-minute cue that's going to suggest this couple is really trying to work it out. There's some love in their relationship that's still left. And there's this event on the horizon that their love can overcome. And this movie may happen. Let's see. Chris Bowers is the composer for the movie Green Book. It's in theaters now. And that's The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.